This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of EdUp Legal. Today, my guest is Jason McKee, the founder of Perspective Tester. And we're going to focus our conversation today on website accessibility. So welcome, Jason. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm happy to be here.
Before we dive in, sometimes I like to share how I met my guests because they come from sort of all kinds of experiences that I have. And you and I were fortunate to have met at a conference. I believe we met in Charlotte. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes, at the NASCAR Hall of Fame we met.
Yes.
So, yes. You know, I always say I love going to conferences in the marketing space because they are way more fun and exciting than conferences in the legal space. We don't do things at the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
It was a fun time. That was a good time.
Yes, it was fun. And then also, I love that you reached out to me because this is an issue that you're passionate about and that you wanted to sort of bring more awareness to. Sometimes my podcast episodes are because it's an issue that I'm interested in, and then I go out and try to find someone to talk about it. So it's always great for me when somebody says, hey, you know, I'd love to use your podcast as a platform to share something that's important. So thank you for reaching out to me. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate that. And as a founder of a small business, you know, you're always promoting yourself. So if you see an opportunity to get the message out, you always say, hey, what about this topic? You know,
so my passion project on the side is, in addition to this, this is clearly a passion project for me, is the Ready, Set, GC program I found for new women general counsel. And so I hear you, small business, grassroots, labor of love. I'll talk to anybody about it who will listen.
I love that you say it's your passion project on the side, considering all three are side gigs. You already have a permanent high power position, but all of this stuff is a side gig. So it's hilarious that you have multiple sides.
I do think that this podcast was supposed to be sort of an interim fun thing to do while I looked for my next opportunity, but I started doing it and I kind of got the bug. And then I went with Joe to Middle States and we podcasted live from there. And I thought, oh, I could do this all the time. This is so much fun.
Oh, great. Great.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. We attended the 2-day conference in Philadelphia, got some great live podcasts episodes that we recorded. So it was really fun. Okay. Any event. So let's dive in. So tell me sort of how did you come to this space? Because I know for lots of people in higher ed. And one of the things I love about this topic is it's so much broader than higher education. And how did you arrive here?
Yeah, it's a big topic, and it kind of fell into my lap, and I'm eternally grateful for the way the universe kind of forces you into things sometimes. I was I had a small marketing business, which was not doing well. And I had a meeting with a potential client. We had spoken on the phone, but not yet in person. And when I got to the conference room, he was using a screen reader to go through his emails, and it was out loud in the room. And the speed at which the audio was coming out, and the fact that the man was blind and I hadn't anticipated or expected or realize it all in one moment, it stopped me in my tracks. And I started in that instant to see that there was a new perspective from people that I was trying to communicate with online, from my clients, mostly from the marketing side of things, that I just hadn't considered. And of course, we all know someone with a disability in our life, but when it came to business, I just put on these narrow blinders and didn't think about it. And at that point I had been in the tech world for quite a few years. I'm no spring chicken. And in all the meetings I'd had and all the conversations I'd had and the pitches and the contracts and the campaigns, it had never come up once. And all these different billion-dollar companies that we worked with and agencies that we worked with and contractors and partners, no one had ever brought this up. So when this gentleman started telling me that he just recently lost his vision and he was upset that nothing worked for him, and he was even more upset that there was laws in the books and no one was paying attention and no one was listening to him, I in a very short period of time realized this is something that needs some energy behind it, which I have, and it needs a voice, which I have probably too much of sometimes. And it was exciting. And it was, it was one of those.
Me too.
You and I, we're a little outspoken, right? So this community doesn't have a lot of outspoken defenders. A lot of these people that I've gotten to meet over the years as running this business, they become extremely patient. I even have a friend who's paralyzed at the neck from an accident at work. And his personality, he's still the same guy, but he's become very, very patient with the world because nothing works for him. Nothing ever works for him. And he just assumes that that's the way it's going to be. So there's not a lot of noisemakers. There's not a lot of people shouting that not only, we're not saying we need to change the rules. The rules are already there. We're not saying we need to change the way HTML works because HTML was already accommodates this. It's just that nobody's paying attention. So 7 days after that meeting with that man, I stopped everything else and started a business on accessibility. And it's been an absolute blessing. The personal relationships, the way my perspective has changed, the way I've seen companies adopt this and appreciate it and see all these side benefits that come about once they start becoming accessible and taking a moment to consider the perspective of people with disabilities. It's no longer just a job or a business. It's a mission, and it's one I'm very proud of, and I'm humbled to be part of it. And with this topic that we're going to talk about today, a lot more people are going to hear about this. There's nowhere to hide anymore for people who are running their business online. So I look forward to talking about that, and I appreciate you giving us a voice on your platform.
Happy to do so. I'm excited about the topic. And, you know, we talked about this a little before we started recording that, you know, as a lawyer, as a general counsel for, you know, at two higher education organizations, I saw, you know, accessibility demands. I saw lawsuits related to this. And so I'm excited to talk about it from the real world perspective, not necessarily how do you defend this when you get sued, but what does it mean to have your website be accessible? What does it mean to be focused on this because it's the right thing to do, not because somebody's going to sue you someday? So let's talk a little bit about your business, about what are the services that you offer? What do you focus on? How do you help organizations with this issue?
Perspective Tester is a consultancy for accessibility compliance solutions. So that covers everything, everything online. We don't deal with anything in the physical realm, but websites, content, apps, portals, you know, web systems, where we're in healthcare a lot, you know, talking about confidentiality of someone's personal health records. Has that system, where they're uploading those for their insurance company, has that been tested by someone who's disabled? If not, how do you know that they're not asking a friend to do that upload for them or things like that? So we test, you know, that's really where, if anybody is out there and has just been received their first demand letter and they hear somebody say, oh, that's just those darn professional plaintiffs. They're just trying to get a few dollars from you. It's just a scam. We test from the perspective of people with disabilities. Now, that doesn't mean that we just find someone with a disability and ask them to use your app. There are legal requirements in accessibility compliance. So, and there's certifications. So it's kind of like if you're going to go to your backyard and build a shed and you start wiring it up, you know, the city or the county is going to show up and say, who's doing the electrical on this? Who's certified to do this? And you can't say, oh, no, I got it. Don't worry, I'm going to figure it out. That's the way business operates in our society. This is not me making the rules. This is how we operate. So when you're going to build a website for your business, you're going to have to test from the perspective of people other than you and your partner and your employees. You're going to have to test from the perspective of people with disabilities. So that's the core offering that we have, is we test manually through assistive technology devices. So this most of the time means a screen reader. So someone who's visually impaired would have a screen reader navigate the website. So they're hitting tab, and the cursor is moving across the website, and then it's reading back the information that's in the HTML. So if there's a button, it'll tell them where the button's going to take them. If there's a navigation bar that has a drop-down accordion menu, it'll tell them what's in that menu, what is the submenu, and then if they click on something, where they're going to go. This is the core offering that we provide, because it's something that, you know, some of our clients have thousands of websites and 100 people on their IT staff. you know, they know how to build websites. They're experts at it. They don't need help with development, but they need help understanding what the compliance means in this instance. And that's going to be in our reporting. We're going to say, well, we tested it and this is what we found. Now, the assistive technology, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's interesting because, well, one of the issues here, right, is it's questionable whether there are defined laws that tell you what to do. So you have the ADA and the question about whether the ADA was written for this type of, you know, for a website, for this type of accessibility. And then you have the WCAG standards, which are not law. So are they really the law you're supposed to be following? But I think your perspective is one, you know, it's a completely different perspective, which I think now, you know, when I think about the name of your business now, right, Perspective Tester, you test from that perspective, which is, you know, what I hear people talking about is, you know, the Wave tool and these online site checkers that aren't necessarily testing from that perspective. So I think I just kind of want to maybe, those waters seem very, very muddy to me. And sort of how do we make clarity about, and I know we'll talk about this towards the end of the podcast, which is what are some takeaways, but how do we, you know, less muddy the waters about what you as a business, what you as a legal team, what you as your IT team is supposed to be thinking about when you're talking about, are my sites, is my app, you know, are the business functions that I have accessible?
Well, there's a couple of good points in there. One is the legality and what that means. And two is how you go ahead to fix these problems, how you test and how you make sure that you're following those laws. So a lot of businesses will say, well, it's not fair because the Department of Justice doesn't, you know, the ADA doesn't have websites in it. It was put forth in 1990. There's a very interesting story about how the ADA came about. We can probably touch on another time, but that was a man who was born with epilepsy, who grew up, his a very strict Catholic family. And when you had epilepsy as a Catholic, you were told that you were possessed by the devil and you could not be a member of the church. So his dream was to be a priest. And because that dream was impossible, because he believed he was possessed by the devil, he became an alcoholic and lived on the streets. He was rescued from the streets by Bob Hope, the famous comedian from the previous generations. Random story. And his name's
Tony.
I know
who Bob Hope is.
Good. Some of your listeners might not.
I agree. Some of my listeners will have no idea who Bob Hope was.
But this gentleman's name was Tony Coelho, and Bob Hope got him on his feet and introduced him to some people. And everyone found out that this was a pretty special guy. So he ended up working for an elected representative in Southern California as a staffer, and eventually worked in Washington, D.C. for the congressional office. And after that, sorry about the sirens. After that, he was elected to the vacant seat after his employer resigned. So he became a politician. And as soon as he did, he realized he had an ability to change the way people saw people with disabilities. So he wrote that law with the help of George Bush Sr. And he tells a story publicly about how he bumped into George Bush Sr. shortly before George Bush Sr. died. And he was in a wheelchair and he smiled at Tony and he said, you know, I got into this building, you know, no problem because of our ADA law. Like everything is working now. We changed society and we made it possible for people with disabilities.
What a great story.
It's a really great story. And his parents, unfortunately, never believed that he wasn't possessed by the devil. He had to live the rest of his life and they passed thinking that he still couldn't get into heaven. So his perspective has changed on, he's still a very religious person. He even met the Pope as an elected official. It's a very, very interesting guy. And that's why that law is so transformative in our society, because it's the only time any civilization in recorded history has said, let's make a precedent here and let's make sure that we're accommodating people who are vulnerable. You know, no, societies don't do that the way that America did that. So that, and I'm saying all this because if you're going to start interpreting the ADA law on the web, you have a couple of options. You can look at the history of that and you can look at our country and you can say, oh, maybe they don't mean websites are important. Maybe that I can just get away with running my business online because I don't have a storefront. You can pretend that. But if you look at the court records, you will see the Department of Justice is the enforcer for this. They sue people all the time. They just sued the state of Oklahoma because the state of Oklahoma's websites and apps weren't accessible. And in their settlement, because this Oklahoma was going to lose that case, the Department of Justice said, you're going to be WCAG 2.1 AA compliant. Now, that's a big string of letters. But what that means, the WCAG, which you mentioned earlier, is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. These guidelines were developed by Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who invented the World Wide Web and then gave it to the world for free. He knew that third parties were going to have to act on this web that was being created for things like people with disabilities, specifically for blind people. He knew way back then that there was going to need to be a device that was not visual and could interpret this information for those folks, plus a million other different ways. So that WCAG continues. Now we're up to 2.2 as of today. The W3C is the organization that brings all that together through volunteers, including us, my team, from around the world. And these are very intelligent, very hardworking people that come in to develop those standards that can be adopted by everybody. It's not a law. That's true. However, when the Department of Justice uses that in all of their settlements, say, well, here's how you're going to fix it. You're going to become WCAG compliant. I think it's safe to tell my clients that that's the standard we're going to use. So that's what we test against. And that's what we get our clients compliant with. And that protects them from these lawsuits.
And it's interesting because recently in July of last summer, the DOJ came out with a proposed rulemaking to look at web and mobile app accessibility for people. Now, I think it's a little unclear to me whether it's really geared just towards, public, state, federal, local, and as opposed to private entities. But regardless, once the DOJ comes out with guidelines, those guidelines generally should become best practice for any organization. So then you'll have these, the WACG guidelines, I'm sorry, WCAG guidelines, and something from the Department of Justice. So, a lot more teeth, I guess, into doing this.
Well, the proposed rule change from last summer is a colossal shift in how we interact with the internet. It's that broad. There's 86,000 organizations that are at the mercy of that rule change right now. And if you read that, which it's a very long document, but a lot of it is explaining why it's taken them so long to get here. They've always been on the way to provide clarity on what it means to be accessible and compliant with your digital properties. But they have done an exhaustive search. They've looked at all the websites and the documents, because documents also have to be remediated. A PDF is just an image. If you can't see it, there's nothing there. There's no information there. So everything has to be fixed. And they know they talk in that release that they just put together. And I believe it is 50,000 pages. It's something like that. It's huge. They say that it is going to take X amount of time, X amount of man hours, X amount of dollars to do these fixes. And it's usually less than 1% of the state revenues. So they say, we know it's a lot, but we don't see this as a hardship for anyone. Now, they specifically pull out two categories inside Title II. Title II, and I'm not an attorney, but from my understanding, if you're playing with government money, you're going to fall into Title II. If you're a local municipal government, if you're a public education system, if you're a higher education organization that is playing with government money, with federal government money, you fall under the umbrella of Title II. In those release notes, the DOJ has said they put the higher ed and the healthcare communities both on notice. We see this as in your, this is part of your, you're going to have to adopt this, these rules. Healthcare, for obvious reasons, a lot of people have disabilities and health problems when they're trying to maneuver through documentation and doctor's offices and insurance companies. So there's not a lot of argument saying, oh, we shouldn't have to. And higher ed, the DOJ has said, the only reason we don't have specifics here on what it's going to cost you to do this is because the online courses are behind logins and we don't have the logins. But you're on notice that everything has to be accessible. They say there's some exceptions in there. And I know there's going to be attorneys on the higher ed side arguing for those exceptions to try to save money. But one of them, for example, is as long as there's nobody who's disabled in any of those courses, you don't have to have them tested. Now, the next sentence in their release notes is 60% of people with disabilities never identify those disabilities to their employers, to their teachers, to anybody else. So you can start taking risks if you want, but it's up to you.
Yeah, and the law does, you know, a fairly nice job of protecting people with disabilities that don't want to disclose them or don't need to disclose them, right? So that's a whole nother podcast, the ADA and employment. It also looks like, you know, to your point that the Justice Department is really interested in that, is that a note that just last month they also announced a proposed rulemaking as it relates to medical diagnostic equipment. So I know you're not in the physical space, but they're looking at having making sure that medical diagnostic equipment is accessible to people with disabilities. So clearly something on their, you know, on their agenda, on their radar now. So what would be some sort of takeaways, some best practices, some advice? People are listening to this, they're not sure, you know, how accessible are they? When was the last time they looked? Oh, we looked a year or two ago. Do we need to look again? So maybe it's a couple of takeaways for people listening. And again, I go back to this, and you just said it. This is so much broader than just higher ed. I know I focus this podcast on higher ed, but I find that many of the episodes we do have implications that are, you know, just broader than just higher ed. So what are some good takeaways or suggestions for best practices people could be looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. There, and I think I failed to answer one question from previously when you asked about how we actually do our testing. So, how we do this is a manual effort. Now, there's software that helps. So, there are some scanners out there that can look at the HTML structure of a site, and it can identify how the H tags are implemented on a site, for instance, because H1, H2, H3, and H4. These are things that designers and developers use to style pages. They make things bolder and bigger and one and smaller and more nondescript than another, but that's not what their intent is in HTML. Those are specific to importance of information so that if someone gets to an H1, they should be able to assume that that's the most important topic of a page, not some kind of design feature or an accent that's being used by the developer. And this is something that's very simple. But it does get in the way of somebody being able to navigate the site and understand the site, especially when it's not just simple information like, you know, entertainment. It becomes a critical issue. So it's important to understand if you're in a position right now where you are all of a sudden this lands on your desk and you're like, I have to figure out a way to do this in a that doesn't, you know, exhaust all of our resources, but most importantly, it doesn't waste any resources. I don't want to spend a bunch of money and then find out I did the wrong thing, obviously. So the question that you should be asking any vendor that's at your desk and saying you should hire us is, how do you test? How are you testing? If I'm going to buy a LMS and I'm running a higher ed institution and I'm going to spend millions of dollars on the platform that's going to hold all of our online courses, and they say, oh, don't worry, we're compliant, we're accessible and compliant. I see this once a week. Nobody asks, how do you know you're compliant? How do you know you're accessible? Oh, well, we've been doing this for a long time. How do you know? How do you test? Oh, well, we have the software. It's really good. No, if they say the word software, you can go to the next one. If they're not manually testing for accessibility compliance, they are not compliant. And not only are they not compliant, but they're automatically vulnerable to a lawsuit that you were going to lose because the professional plaintiff came by and saw you had no accessibility policy on your website, and they could see in 2 seconds that there was a couple of things there that show them that you have not tested for accessibility. You are a sitting duck. Even if you're spending money for that software, the overlays, you want to talk about things to avoid. There, you know, the overlay fact sheet is something that you can find online with a simple Google, or we'll just start Googling problems with overlays, accessibility overlays, and all these things will pop up. There are companies making tens of millions of dollars a year right now selling overlay software. It's automated software. It auto magically fixes all your accessibility problems, and it's cheaper. It's now the last time I saw competing quotes from one of those companies from one of my clients, they were the same price as us for doing all this work the correct way, and plus we get to employ people who have disabilities who are also accessibility professionals, testers, and developers. So there's a lot of good reasons to use companies like mine, but when you start getting told that this magic software is going to solve your problems, you should beware. Because right now there are professional plaintiffs who are looking for those little disability icons on the websites, and they're just filing a lawsuit when they see it, or a demand letter when they see it. They already know if you're using that, you're not compliant because those things do not work. The people selling them aren't disabled and don't use them. The people buying them aren't disabled and don't use them. And nobody's asking the question, what do these things do for someone who's disabled? Nobody's asking that question. So the question the people need to be asking is, how are you testing? And once you start realizing that that's the crux of this entire issue, eventually you land on a company like ours that we pride ourselves in how we test. Now, after the testing's done, the remediation, you know, the fixes that have to be made to make sure that it is accessible for everyone is a bit complicated. A lot of really top dev teams, they can handle it, even though they don't know what to fix it to. So we have to show them why it's a problem, to explain it, and then they can do the fixes because they understand the code forwards and backwards. But we're one of the few organizations that also offer remediation services because we have developers who are also accessibility professionals. And again, that's, if you're just running a magic software company, you're not going to have, you're not going to pay for resources like that. So it's something that we expect, this colossal shift that is happening right now in accessibility because of the proposed rule change with Title II of the ADA is just the very small tip of a gigantic iceberg, because what comes after number two, number three, Title III has also been, all the private corporations out there have been complaining, well, there's no clarity in the ADA law online, what we're supposed to be doing. Well, for years, the DOJ has been suing private companies for accessibility violations, and the settlements have been demanding that they adhere to WCAG standards. We already know what the Department of Justice looks at when they look for accessibility compliance. So if you're just running a private company and you say, well, we're small, or we don't have a physical presence in the world, it's just a remote experience for us, you can tell yourself these things all you want. But as far as we see it, the rules are changing, and the government is going to have these things clarified. And they say in these notes, once they do, the clock starts ticking. And if you're a large organization, more than 50,000 employees, you're going to have 2 years to have everything tested and fixed. I can tell you right now, if you have a large company, you know, it's going to take you more than 2 years. So you better start now, because it's going to be easy for them to start hitting people with severe penalties. Like I said, Oklahoma just got sued. Department of Justice is making an example. They're saying, this is what we mean. You haven't tested these apps. You're not compliant. You are going to fix them. And what are you going to do? You can't fight the Department of Justice. And who wants to fight on this anyway? Who's against this? Who's against people being able to access information online? We just went through a pandemic where everyone was told, stay home and use your phone and your computer. What about the people who live alone and they're disabled? What are they supposed to do? This is not a parking space close, so it's more convenient. This is not, there's people, I know some people roll their eyes at the ADA. They're so sick of all the accommodations that they see at the airports and things like that. Maybe it does go too far sometimes, but this, when you're paying your bills or communicating with family members or doing your job or applying for a job or applying for medical benefits or finding out what Medicare and Medicaid benefits you might qualify for, this is life and death stuff. And if you're against this movement, then I would like to hear your argument, because I have yet to hear a good one.
Well, your passion is clearly self-evident, and I agree with you. I mean, how can you be against making your website accessible to the disabled? Like, that's just a hard stop there. Thank you. This has been really just a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate sort of the proactive sort of what can you do to be thinking about. It definitely gives people a lot to think about, and especially, you know, when I think about higher ed, right? Higher ed's main goal is to provide education to everybody. So the idea that this is, well, I'm not saying it's not an important focus, it is, but it should be an important focus for all businesses, but particularly in businesses whose job are, whose mission is to educate and educate everyone. It's not, we just educate those that are not disabled. So, you know, I think it's a wonderful topic for an audience of higher ed listeners. So I thank you for taking the time, and it was really great to chat with you.
Thank you, Deborah. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.